Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 135, featuring Jay Bush, who is now at Google, but formerly of ICT, and Mike Seymour, who is founder of FX Guide, FX PhD. But more importantly, he is also doing a lot of research in terms of virtual humans, and he's doing a PhD in terms of virtual humans. And the most important thing, which is really what this whole podcast is about, he also happens to be the subject of our next WikiHuman project. So the next WikiHuman, the next data set you get will actually be Mike himself, the face, the scan, etc. And this podcast is sort of helping us recoup all the information that's been missing for the last few years that we haven't really made public, because we actually have been doing a lot of work on the WikiHuman project and going back and forth. There's a lot of things that happened, and we discuss that. But anyway, this is sort of tells you where we're going with it. The good news for you guys, especially those who are interested in the project, is that I expect to be able to have a new data set out for everyone very, very soon. And you guys can be able to take advantage of that. And it'll be great because it has a lot of the information, such as Mike's hair, Mike's eyes that were scanned at Disney, research in Zurich, his face that, you know, comes from ICT. So lots of information is out there, a lot of stuff that we can explore together and you guys can use for your research. One of the great things that happened that we discuss on this is, also, let me take a step back. Every year when we go to SIGGRAPH, the cool thing is a lot of people that are involved in the WikiHuman project happen to be there. So we try to get together and have just a quick meeting. And it always ends up, you know, like half an hour, just to meet in person and just bounce some ideas off of what's our goals for the next year. It's kind of amazing that in that short time, we can sort of come up with some great ideas. And last year, what we said was make Mike move. We wanted basically said, we have the Mike data. What are we going to do with it? We're going to make him move. And that was accomplished mainly by some ideas from Mike himself and him getting some great collaboration from companies like Epic and 3Lateral and Cube Motion and many more to create something that became a really cool event at SIGGRAPH this year called Meet Mike. And what that was basically Mike it rendered in real time in VR having meetings with other people. Kind of a surreal experience. I actually got to do it myself, and I really, really enjoyed it. I think it's very, very interesting, the whole idea of a digital avatar and what that means and where it's going to go. So really, really great work to see there. And thanks so much, Mike, for getting everything sort of set up. And all the great collaborators were wonderful on this project. So really appreciate it. So I'm really hoping that we'll be able to get the Mike data out soon. I can't commit to anything because really most of the work done on this is very volunteer based. So that's, you know, you'll get it when it's ready. But I'm really trying to get something interesting. And for next year, we have some really interesting plans, which I don't want to commit to yet. But I think overall, we'll be very happy. I can say that one of the things we would love to do is to hear more from the community. What would you guys want with this new data? What would you guys like us to do next with this data? How are some of the things that you would like to, what are some of the things you'd like to see, develop, et cetera, based on the WikiHuman data? Because that's really what we want to do. You want to be serving the community in some way that's benefiting everyone and be able to do some interesting research. So please let us know what you think about that. Besides that, that's all really about WikiHuman. If you happen to be, you know, a regular listener and you know that we bounce from subject to subject, I will tell you that I am going to be at D2, which is a conference that really doesn't have anything to do with digital humans. But it is a really great conference that is in Vienna. I've never been, but I've been told great things, especially by my friend Jeff Muddle, that it's one of the great ArcViz conferences that happens. And so we're very much looking forward to it. There's actually going to be several of us from Chaos Group that are going, and we are looking forward to the to what we'll be presenting there, because there's going to be some great announcements, and I'm excited about that. I'm also excited that I'm going to be doing some podcasts while I'm there, so I'm going to be recording those. So look forward to those podcasts at D2. That's actually coming up in a couple of weeks, so I better start packing my bags. Seems like I'm on the road a lot these days. All right. That being said, hopefully you guys will enjoy this great podcast with Jay and Mike from the Digital Human League and great collaborators on the WikiHuman project. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Can I get a show of hands of how many of you have actually listened to a CG Garage podcast? Oh, getting an audience. This is great. And actually, these two people have been on before, and they're both have individually very popular podcasts that have been on. Like, the episodes have been very popular. So I'm very excited to have them back. And Mike, of course, has his own. Many podcasts. How many podcasts have you done, Mike?
That's a good question. I worked it out once. I'd done over 1,000 interviews, but across multiple podcasts and stuff.
Right.
I mean, I've been doing it too long because I'm old. it's good. We started in 99, so I guess we've done a few.
Right. And Jay, you've been on just my podcast once? Oh, three podcasts? Which other ones have you been on?
Oh, there was yours, and then they recorded the panel.
Was your mic on?
It says it's on.
Okay, just making sure.
Can I adjust it for you?
Yes.
What are you doing, Mike? Is that better?
Is it better?
Not Is it better?
Yeah, you need to run that slide.
Okay, we're good.
Is that better?
Yeah, there you go. So you've been on my podcast?
Your podcast. I did a VR panel that they put on as a podcast VR filmmaking.
Uh-huh.
And then they put one up. I was on a panel for high schoolers finding their way into VR education.
Ah, okay. Cool. Well, that sounds great. So we should probably tell people why you guys are here. You guys are two, there's many members of the Digital Human League, but you guys are two of them. And in recent months, we've actually been communicating with each other a lot on a daily or many times daily basis. So there was something that we wanted to do. Mike, why don't you tell them a little bit about what we've been pulling off over the last year, where all this stuff started.
Sure. I mean, I thought you were going to start with why we're here. And I'd have to say we're here because of this guy at the end of the table, because Chris has done an enormous job for the industry. I mean, supported well by Chaos, don't get me wrong, but he's really been an incredible force for putting together several teams, of which we're part of one of them, that contribute, and I really mean that, contribute to the community. And the mandate that that Chris started, that hopefully the rest of us have fallen in line with, is this idea of being able to develop things that we can give to the community. In other words, assets and understanding and insights that everyone can share, rather than doing something that's proprietary, that of course you're really cool, but I can't give you the assets because obviously somebody else owns them. And in our case, it's the WikiHuman project.
Yeah, it was an initiative that started at the very early stages of me working at Chaos Group, and we sort of said we want to explore some of the tools we're using to create character work. And I said, I want to go all the way to the top. I want to create digital humans. I want to work on that. And the only way I knew how to do that is the way I always do things, is call some of my friends, because I can't do that, honestly. I can't do it on my own. I don't think anyone can. We all have to rely on each other, on each other's strengths to do it.
The film industry is a collaborative sport.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And so I talked to Paul DeBevick and Jay also over at ICT at the time, and we were looking at, they said, we have an asset we can work with. And so we work with Digital Emily. And Digital Emily we worked on it, we did scans, we've got a lot of information, and we basically have since given out Digital Emily as an asset from the WikiHuman project. So anyone can go to wikihuman.org and it'll have a link, it actually links back to an ICT link, and you can get the Digital Emily data and try it out. But the problem we had was that Emily, who's a very nice and sweet person, has a career as an actress and is not always available for scanning and probing. As we tend to do when we do that. And so we said, I know someone who likes to be scanned and probed. And that was Mike. So
actually, if I can just correct you there. What you actually said is we need a face that some people may have seen. and we need a face that's really attractive. And I said, well, okay. And he said, so I don't think we can get anyone attractive, but people have seen your face.
Yeah, it's true.
So if we do your face, then they'll be able to judge not just is it look human, but is it recognizable? And at that point, we really seriously thought, and I think it's been borne out, there's a big difference between just saying, does something look good, and does something look like somebody that you actually know?
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Because, I mean, what was the story we were looking at? We had a scan of Paul Dubevic at one point, and the...
Well, maybe you can tell the story.
Yeah, tell the story about Paul.
One new magazine.
I know a lot of stories about
the
Paul.
Yeah, but you remember when we did the first renders of him, and there was like the bald Paul.
Bald Paul.
Yeah. So ironically, Paul had decided to shave for Halloween that year. That was what inspired us to try to do the scan of him, because he didn't have his normal goatee.
His normal goatee, right.
So we scanned him, and he wanted to try using it as a test subject outside of Emily, mostly because I think somebody, and I don't remember who said this, but they said they were tired of seeing pretty women, so they wanted to do someone who was masculine, more detail, more kind of someone who's lived through life a bit more and less makeup. So we decided to do Paul as a test bed, but Paul did not have a skull. We only had Paul's face at the time.
Right.
So we had a very selective set of data. We had the scan of him. We had the diffuse albedo, the specular albedo, which is separated, so the shine versus the color of the skin. We had all the displacement map details and such, but we need someone to sculpt the back of the head. And as we started going through that, we started to realize that we need to take a much deeper data set capture. We want to actually make this go further, and then we also wanted to explore motion.
Right.
So we thought Mike might be more tolerant to being tortured.
Well, we also, with Paul specifically, we sort of made up the back of the head at one point.
We did, completely
and so
artistically.
Matt Arney just sort of like, whoop, I'll just give him the back of his head. But the shape of his skull was too big.
It was a bit round.
It was a bit rounder. And it was not like massively, like if you didn't know Paul.
So I think that's the thing, is if you didn't know Paul, you said, that looks great. If you did know Paul, you went, it looks wrong. And then everyone would start going, well, the eyes are wrong. No, the eyes are right. Well, the mouth, no, the mouth's wrong. And it was actually the skull. And have you guys seen the Thatcher effect? If you get someone's face turned upside down, but re-invert their eyes and their mouth, right? Head's upside down, you look at it, you go, that's kind of all right. The head's upside down, maybe something's off, but you know, whatever. Take that same JPEG and turn it upside down again. Now the head is the right way, but the eyes and the mouth are wrong. And you go, oh my God, I'm going to die. Run. Because it's so, you know, horrendous. And so there's this thing that happens in your brain that you process faces quite differently. And so while we often find it hard to articulate that, our brain is like flashing on things. And so we were flashing on, that's not Paul's silhouette. Though our brain wasn't cognitively able to immediately tell us what's wrong is the skull. In other words, you kind of get the sense that it's wrong, but it's not immediately obvious. And in fact, that's why I believe visual effects supervisors are very good at their job, is they're actually able to access those parts of their brain that are kind of bypassing straight logic. They can tell you what's wrong in the frame, where we all just say it's wrong and don't know why. A good supervisor will go, oh, that's what's tripping you. Mm-hmm. And so, the fact is, to my wife, it looked like Paul Dubevic because she hadn't met him, and to us, it was like, that's not our Paul. Hmm.
You look like a meathead.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. But anyway, so these are the things that we've discovered along the way, which has been pretty interesting. I think we have an interesting andas. Honestly, a lot of people, you know, their goal is to try to get out of the uncanny valley as much as possible. I love the uncanny valley because I'm fascinated by what causes it, what's doing it, trying to understand that, you know, as opposed to just like, I don't know, just get out of it. I want to actually know, like, why does it exist? Why do we react the way we do? What's happening in this area? It's kind of a interesting thing. But we did ultimately decide to scan Mike. And so, Jay, why don't you walk us through? We did a pretty detailed scan at ICT of Mike, and this was actually 2 years ago, believe it or not.
I've got the slides for that if you want to show the audience.
We can
be fun.
Is that all right? Well,
that
while you're talking, I can get them up.
I mean, it's
sure,
a podcast,
sure.
but there are people.
See, for everyone listening, I'm sorry, we're going to have to describe.
Well, can we not post them somewhere?
We can. We can, actually.
I'm going to save that. You keep talking, Jay.
How detailed do you want to go?
Well, let's start with what we did on Mike. What's the basic scan of Mike, for example, or a digital human at ICT?
So at ICT, we have specific type of technology in which we are capable of digitizing humans not only on a geometric level, but also on a reflectance level. We are not only able to capture your shape, the detail of your pores, but we are also able to capture measurement of how much your skin subsurface scatters, how much of the reflectance of the light comes off of the first layer of your skin, things of that kind of nature. We do this inside of a structure called the light stage. It's fundamentally a ball of light. It's a ball, and it has, at the time, 346 lighting units, each individually controlled through a computer system, so that way we can have complete control over the lighting. The reason that's important is because when you're able to control the lighting, you can actually do what we call gradients across your face, whether it's an X gradient, where it's brighter on the right, darker to the left. Sorry, I keep bumping my mic. Y gradient, bright on the top, and then Z gradient, bright on the front. And this is important because it shows us how the light will cast across the surface of your face. When we're able to see that, we're able to actually calculate the shape of your face based on how the light falls across it. From the images that we capture in this nature, we can extract your base geometry, so the shape of your head, or your face fundamentally, because hair isn't very friendly in some aspects. The pore level detail, where it goes into, where your pores go in, where they come out. How much of the light scatters underneath, we pull that off of by polarizing the light, by canceling the shine off the top layer of the skin. Then we're able to calculate how much of the shine actually comes back off of your skin, so we get your specular map. And all of that comes together to be able to render a hyperreal version of whomever in which we scan. When you do that with one expression, we call that, usually it's the neutral expression. It tends to go out to studios where they'll remesh it, make it animatable. But what you can also do, and what we did with Mike, is we put him through a rigorous amount of expressions. What was our count?
Oh, it's a lot. If we can find the drive, it's got...
Hold on, just a second.
It was over 30.
Keep talking, Jen.
I'm not sure we hit 60, but we were pretty close.
Yeah. That defines our expression space.
Yes, so that allowed us to measure all the range of motion, so to speak, of Mike's face. Not only just the emotions that he can make, but how high can he raise his eyebrows, how wide can you puff your cheeks, how much can you suck them in. And the interesting thing about that is, in each expression, the blood on your face tends to shift around. And your cheeks will get more pale if you puff out your cheeks, because this blood will shift to a place where there isn't so much tension, or vice versa when you raise your eyebrows and all the blood collects in other regions. We'll correspond all of that together. So when you make blend shapes, you correspond all your expressions to your neutral, so you can actually make it be a puppet. But when you actually correspond the textures, you can blend the textures in to the corresponding expression, which then mimics how the blood flows underneath the skin. It gives someone more of a vibrant, human-like, living nature. This is something that was really big when we worked on a movie of Maleficent they did with the fairies. It was a good measurement for them. And so all of this, for example, it's going to probably hopefully come up here soon.
Yeah.
We did this to Mike for, I think, was it a full day, or did we get you back a second day?
No, it was a full day. We actually did two, if you remember. Mm. Actually, I don't need this front one. I'm going to jump down to where we got to. You guys are at the, I'd already passed Thatcher.
Yeah.
I had this worked out so well. Okay, just going to pass that. There we go. That's Emily.
Yeah, so this is Emily. Actually, it's Emily 2.0. The first Emily, I don't know if anybody remembers, back in 2009, we did a composited version of this actress on top of a live plate of film. And we worked with a company called Image Metrics at the time, when they used to do facial animation. That was their specialty. We decided when Chris invited us to join the Digital Human League, we wanted to do this in a full CG head, no compositing, proper subsurface scattering, and see how far we can actually push the science of our capture to make a hyper-real human, and then be able to publish that online with explanations of how we did it, why it works, and that way people can replicate it in their own time with their own data and see if they understand the logic, so they can replicate with other characters.
Okay, just ignore me while I get a couple of slides. Okay.
So a couple of years later, we decided to do it again, except in this case, we wanted to do someone, like someone brought up, they didn't want to do a pretty woman, they wanted to do someone who has more character in their face. And we wanted to make him move. And as Chris liked to always say, make Mike move is kind of our goal.
Yeah, we basically...
Now we do a bit.
Yeah. So, okay. So we basically sat in a bar last year, and a bunch of us here, Thabo is there, who's over in the audience right now, we were all saying, it's like, what's our goal for the year, for next year? And our goal was to make Mike move, which, honestly speaking, the thing is, it's a little bit of a tall order. All the people involved in Digital Human League are... very, very busy because they're experts in their area. So they kind of have to volunteer their time a little bit to figure out if they have time to work on this project, and some do and some don't. But we were able to pull it off. And actually the last, you know, what we did do when we did make Mike move, and we'll get to that ultimately, that came together pretty quickly thanks to Mike and Jay and everyone who helped out on that side. Of course, there's a lot of other big companies as well, which I'm sure Mike will discuss. But this is all the shapes we had.
The point that we did this scanning of me, it was actually the most detailed scan of any face in human history. I know, right? Awesome.
I mean, the split, we had the microgeometry displacement, which is 16K displacement maps. So we're down to sub, what is it, 10 microns or what, or less than that? Is it about that?
It's about that. It's near that range.
10 microns? Okay. All right. Thank you. which is really, and you're wondering, why is that important? Why do you need to have a displacement that's that dense? Well, here's a great explanation that I had when I talked to Graham Fife, who is also a member of the Digital Human League. And the idea is, if you know the reflection and the breakup of reflections on a face all come down to the detail of the surface, right? And a lot of shaders out there, BRDFs, what they do is they mimic small differences in surfaces. And if you have enough of a detail scan of a face, you barely need any BRDF to work on it. The reflections will just work very naturally. So we don't really need to use, in fact, in the Digital Emily, we used Phong as the reflectant map. That's how we did it, but it was pretty amazing. We did a lot of work to get that, and the 16K displacement map does make a huge difference on reflections, huge difference, and it looks absolutely amazing.
I want to say that the team at USCICT is absolutely, I mean, we probably know this, but just worth reiterating, and it's like absolutely best of class. You know, the most, but they're also just about the nicest people in the world. Jay being the nicest of the nicest people. And so
she is the best.
Yeah, and so
we love Jay.
But as much as USC is genius, there's a point at which they're like, you know, scope of work stops. And so I think at this point the story needs to move on a little, yeah, just because we also had some other people contribute.
Yeah, we did, absolutely. So right around this time, while we're doing this, I got an email from, believe it or not, from some of my coworkers, says, have you seen this paper on eyes? And it was this, I was like, oh my God, the most incredible eyes I've ever seen. You know, and I don't mean that romantically, I mean that in a different way. But they were really, really, really detailed, and the amount of stuff they did, and what they discovered was incredible. And those are from our friends over at Disney Research in Zurich, and such an amazing thing. And I was told, it's like, you're gonna have a real hard time getting those guys to contribute. They're really nice. So I said, I'm a smooth talker. I can do this. I can figure this out.
Chris sets charisma to stun.
Yeah. So I decided to talk to Thabo and Derek, who were in town, and of course they're wonderful and sweet, nice people, and they tell me some of the challenges they have. And this is honestly a challenge that we all have, because we're all kind of working on intellectual property, So you can't necessarily share intellectual property very easily, because that defeats the purpose of it being intellectual property. But you can contribute the result of that intellectual property. It was basically what we did at ICT. So the minute I presented, it's like, well, ICT is not open sourcing the light stage. What they're open sourcing is the data resulting from the light stage. So that's what we want to do. And they said, well, we can probably make that work. And so they did, and it was great. So we shipped Mike off to Zurich.
Yeah, I sort of remember it that way. So then we go, let's get Mike's eye scanned. And I you know, knew the guys as well. And so that's great. Now, I don't know if we told you this, but I'm doing my PhD like part-time, just so my kids will call me Dr. Dad. And so ethics approval is really hard, but it's really easy to get ethics approval on yourself. And this is the reason. They don't stop you from torturing yourself. And if you've actually seen like Clockwork Orange, this is in the early days of the research in Zurich. You had to be put in a neck brace. And when my my wife had photos of this sent back from Zurich, she thought, have you had an accident? Have you been at a car wreck? Like, no, just having my eye scanned, darling. So they were super generous, and we actually did some other scanning, which, you know, hopefully will feed into the process. But they basically got, they have a much more streamlined production approach to doing this. So, by the way, this is like research, and if you were to get a project through them right now, they wouldn't go this route. But needless to say, I was more than happy to be tortured by people as good as those guys. And they're, you know, they're Swiss, right? They really know their stuff. So, yeah, we're really great. So we now had eyes and we had a head.
And skin.
We didn't have it moving.
We did not have it moving. So we knew we were starting to put all the pieces together, and it was really looking really, really great. And we said, well, how are we going to make Mike move? And that's a challenge. And you know, that's an important, very important part of digital humans is having to move. And that's really where things can fall apart sometimes. So we knew we had to really put our things to test because Mike was looking pretty good, actually. And we were pretty happy, but we wanted to make a move. So that was really your big push, Mike. I mean, I really...
Yeah, I will say this. If you want to do anything in life, you have to articulate the problem well. And so, you know, being half drunk at a bar at Sigraf last year, we articulated the problem very, very well, which was like, well, what do you want to do to make a move, right? And the thing is, if you think about it from our point of view, there's a number of ways we could have gone. But one of the things that interests me enormously was real time. The stumbling block for either of those two things is the rigging, right? Now, this is not an actual rig. This is just the demonstration. But in the world of faces, rigging is really kind of a critical juncture right now. It's not like there are standard rigs, though there are standard levels that you want to get your rigging to. But they're very much proprietary and stuff. And so we had a number of ways we could go on that, but we wanted to get the rig happening. So while we're thinking about that problem of solving the rig, we kept on going with some of the image testing, and in fact, we're using V-Ray at this point, right? So I just want to flag this because this is like all happening in parallel. It's not a sequential sequence. And I thought the guys were getting really good results. I was bald also, you should point out at this stage. We didn't have any hair.
Yeah, we didn't have hair.
Which didn't seem to bother you, but it bothered me. So that's great. And anyway, so we're doing this. Anyway, at this point in time, it seemed like a good idea to go real time. Now, I just want to, I've sort of said this to a number of people, but real time is like a lot harder than it sounds. Like you think real time, right? Can't be that much harder. I say, well, you do the math, right? It's 2.5 hours a frame, maybe, if you want to do a high-end render sometimes. That's not unreasonable in production. And we wanted to do 30 milliseconds. It's like, well, that I worked out was 144,000 times faster, right? So I did the math the other day. So if you're in a 747, you could get to London in 24 hours, which is something. But 2.5 hours get you, I think, to Rome. And that same jet can go 4 meters in the amount of time we had to go, right? So if 2.5 hours of render is a year of your work, we had to get the whole job done in 1.9 minutes, like your whole year's work in 1.9 minutes, right? So that seemed to be like a dumb idea, but we wanted to think about it. And then we could get some interest in it if we went to VR. Thought, oh, that sounds good. How much harder can VR be than real time? Well, it turns out that's 90 frames a second in stereo, right? So all the numbers go down again. So you don't even have those numbers. You actually end up with now 0.6 of a meter and 18 seconds to get a year's worth of work done, right? So like it just seemed at this point virtually impossible. But luckily, I was ignorant, so I kept on going. So we want to get it super real. We want it in real time. We want it in stereo VR, and we wanted it. Oh, and then somebody said, get back to your point about the Uncanny Valley. There's a comparison that's really interesting in the Uncanny Valley. And I jumped through it before, but it sounded like there's a point where Woody Allen is Woody in the Toy Story. We love him, and we hate him as the conductor in, you know, Polar Express, but we love him as, you know, Tom Hanks, the favorite actor of an entire generation. But it'd be kind of interesting to ignore the Uncanny Valley, which Chris loves and I hate. And I was just like, what about the two peaks? What if we could just compare the cartoon guy with the real-ish guy? And the other thing is, I don't want to confuse what the Uncanny Valley is. It is not a Turing test of the inability to tell that it's fake. It is just saying that at some point you hate it, but there's also a landing point, I believe, on the other side of the valley where you know it's not real, but it's still cool, right? Now, obviously, some people want photoreal.
Right.
But there's nothing wrong with just appealingly good. And so then we said, okay, so could we introduce like a Facebook level avatar to compare the high-end one with? So you'd have the cartoon and and if we could discover that relationship, that would tell us some more interesting research as well. So now we had super real time in stereo in VR, and by the way, could we get about 20 other cartoon avatars to just compare it to, just at the same time? And so, yeah, so I'm gonna skip through this next bit of inspirational thought and say that we solved that problem by teaming up with another group of people. So Weekly Human luckily managed to, on the same philosophy of appealing from a research point of view, that we're going to be publishing the work, and this is not proprietary, and it's not being used to set up like a new startup. And Chris and I aren't about to quit and have Jay as the president of our new company, but it's actually a research thing that we're going to give back to the community. We got Epic and most of the team that won Real Time Live here last year to jump in, and Loom AI, which is ex-ILM Oscar winners in an AI team in San Francisco, and a couple of other people to come to the party and take the assets that we had that we thought at this stage were complete and put them into a new project that would bring a real-time version of Mike and some comparative avatars to SIDGRAPH. You want to take over?
No, I think you're doing just fine.
Okay, because there's a point here where somebody should have said to us, you know how you thought you had all the assets complete?
Oh yeah, no, we didn't.
Complete.
Yeah.
You haven't quite done your homework because you're not doing a professional job. You're doing this as your sort of, you know, like we're obviously not running a company doing this. And so when we actually went hard at the assets, we realized that we hadn't quite got around to finishing. Well, maybe you'd explain why we screwed up. In fact, I should get on my knees now and apologize to Jay, because this is the point which Jay saves the day.
She totally saved the day. So what was going on?
We left the company. A good portion of the scan team and I had got acquired from ICT into Google. So our pipeline, which was readily available for processing with the render farmer, which we had available to us, was no longer available. So processing became me at home on my one computer by myself for a while.
And we said we had neutral. That's all we had.
We had a neutral expression.
And we had none of the other fact shapes. So all the other shapes had to be processed by hand by this amazing woman on my left.
Well, I did a good portion of it, and I called in a favor with many dinners out to some friends in the lab still. And they allowed me to use the farm still. So basically, I tried doing a lot of the manual labor and then handed it back. And they would babysit it on the farm and then send it back. Because if we waited purely on my computer, because I tried, it wouldn't be done even now, sadly. So, but I actually have a lot of thanks I want to give to a couple people at ICT and a lot more dinners I owe. But
I should take them out to dinner too, because that is amazing. So, but I really appreciate it. Really incredible we got that all done. And you did it in like a month or two, I think, pretty much, right?
The raw scan processing we pulled off in about 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
And then that went to your team. They did the remeshing. We tried to do the corresponding, but we found the better pipeline would be to work with your team because they had a preference. So we worked with them on that corresponding.
Maybe just this room is obviously way above my IQ, but for anyone that happens to be listening that's not quite keeping up with what's going on, we just might explain what we're talking about. It's like you get a face in the light stage, and then you get another face in the light stage, right? Like, so let's say face one is me in the neutral pose because I'm the subject. Face two might be me smiling, right? Okay, face neutral and face smiling, we know our brains see the same lips have now moved to the smiling position, right? But the computer just sees a bunch of points. What we need is correspondence. We need this to understand how it moves from this to this. And so you can have some really good neutral faces, or you could have some really good faces where I'm smiling, but we need to have correspondence.
Right. Yeah. Otherwise, if you don't, the order in which the points your faces are made up in, so for example, if point three is on your ear, on your neutral, and point three is by your eye, on your smile, this point's gonna drag itself over to your eye, which is not how your face moves in expressions. Actually, that'd be really scary.
Yeah.
So you need to do what you would call a corresponding pipeline. That's fundamentally where you tell the computer, this point will go to this point. The smile at the corner of your lip will move from this point in your neutral to the upper portion of this location in your smile. That's usually what blend shapes are. In our case, we also corresponded the textures. Textures are corresponded versus, instead of vertex, they're pixel corresponded. So it makes sure that if you were to line the two textures on top of each other, one in which has Mike smiling where he blushes a little on his cheeks, and then when he's neutral, when he's more evenly flushed. If you were to blend between the two of them, like scroll your opacity in your Photoshop, you'll notice that the blood or color on your cheeks would actually fade in and fade out. But they would not translate at all. They would stay right on top of each other. And that's a good way of knowing when you're actually corresponded correctly.
Right.
So that needed to be done still. So all of that got finished with the help of, three lateral, yeah. There were a lot of people on emails. So I kind of got them all.
Yeah, because that's the thing. There are lessons, right? Lesson number one is state the objective clearly. Lesson number two is have really good friends like Jay. Lesson number three is like enlist a lot of really good companies that you know, like you give an adequate amount of time to do all the work that's required and don't leave it to the last minute.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we'd left a little bit. We didn't went too bad, but we were a little bit tight on time. And so the three lateral team who are in Serbia, who are awesome, mm-hmm. Who make some of the best face rigs in the world, came to the party. Now, they were on Senua, which won at Real Time Live last year. So they're really good at doing this kind of stuff. And they are going to take whatever we do and ultimately have the rig that is going to be driven in real time. Chill bit we haven't got to yet, and then of course it can be rendered in engine.
Yeah. So your goal you were telling me about is like, so I have this idea of what we're going to do with Mike. We're going to make a move, but we're making a move in real time, and we're going to put him in VR, and we're going to capture it, and it's all going to be live at SIGGRAPH. And I said, oh boy.
And you're going to drive it live.
And you're drive it live. So. This is actually available. How many of you guys have gone to see meet Mike downstairs? Okay, if you haven't...
You're my new bestest friends.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely go see it. So it's 10 to 12 on every day?
10:30 to 12:30 every day, yeah. And we have, for example, Dr. Paul Dubevic and Jay joining us. Chris has already been in the Matrix, and you join us in Sydney where we do like a Tonight Show, right? I do a monologue for 10 minutes, and then we do an interview for 10 minutes with the guest in Sydney, all in VR. And it does work, and it works because of the next bit of the equation, if I can keep going. Mm-hmm. So the next bit of the equation is where we get to deep learning. So as most of you know, this is like the number one thing that's kind of sweeping through the entire industry as being really significant. And it's really significant for some really good reasons. The training data, notwithstanding, you have to have it. But once you use the training data to teach the system, then it can run really quite quickly. And so if you're trying to hit this 9-millisecond thing, you need these kind of tools that are slow to set up, but fast to run. And so we have a bunch of them in this pipeline. But the first ones are on my facial reconstruction. So I've got the, there's another funny thing that happened, okay? So we're gonna get a head rig, stereo mounted cameras. And so the company that makes the best ones of these are Technoprops. And so I'm talking to Glenn Derry, and he's like, yeah, you guys gonna get some rigs? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, when? And I thought, like, well, you know, you're doing us some phase. I'm not trying to push you. I'd do it pretty quickly if I was you. And I'm like, hmm? And then I signed an NDA, and I discovered the whole company was about to be bought by Fox, right? And so there was, like, this closing window of, like, we had to airlift out emergency helmets before they disappeared into Fox and were only going to be used on, I think it's been announced now, right? I'm safe in saying this, Avatar is now gone into official prepo. So I was like, we need these rigs fast. Anyway, so we got the rigs out of... Glendarian. So I'm wearing one of their rigs, right? So it's the head and the stereo mounted cameras, which are two computer vision cameras that are a stereo vertical pair, not horizontal, so that we get a good jaw bone movement for pronouncing the words correctly. And that is allowing those engines to resolve markerless point tracking on my face and then solve that into the fact space, the expression space that Jay has so successfully defined for us, and tell the rig that Three Lateral has made with Jay's help how to move Mike's face to make me smile.
Yeah. And it's quite amazing to do it. And I know we're going to be, how are we on time? Oh, we got a little bit of time. But I want to make sure that I ask you guys, because usually on these podcasts, I try to see if there's people questions. So if there's any questions, because we'll keep talking otherwise. If there's any questions, go ahead and start. Because it is a podcast, I'd love it to be on the on that microphone so that everyone can hear it.
I'm going to keep going then. So now we've got the face. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, Chloe's coming up, my fellow ICT friend, so I'm waiting.
Go ahead. I was wondering what was going to be next.
Is the mic on?
Is the mic on? can you say it again?
I was wondering what was going to be the next step moving forward for Mike.
What's body. Next for Mike?
Yeah. Mike body?
Well, the thing is, so much has been done since this whole process with you and you know the guys at Epic and everything else, that we need to sort of ingest all this data again and make it kind of work so that we can give it out. So I want to give out the data, but we also want to give out the idea of animating this at some point. So at first we can't necessarily give out the rig right now. But we can give out the result of the rig. It's kind of the same problem, right? So we're going to try to look at, you know, Mike's performance that we've captured and try to give an animated sequence of Mike so that people can work with that and study that. And eventually, if we're lucky, we'll be able to give out a rig as well. And so that's something that we're hoping that we can achieve. I mean, the goal really is this. This data is for people to use. It's a great baseline for people to use. If people want to start studying digital humans, if they want to do something with it, why not start with this? Because we already know that this data is well acquired, very well calibrated, and we know what it is. And people can use that and start their digital human research or just understanding what it's all about, or learning.
Actually, I also want to give a shout out to the companies involved, because Chaos and, for that matter, Epic, so obviously we're rendering sometimes in V-Ray, sometimes in the Unreal Engine, especially here at the show. But they're all cool with the fact that we've also given the head to the Pixar team. And so they're playing with my head in RenderMan, right? Yep. And so this is pretty good, right? Because obviously you could argue, well, you know, why would we want to give the competition these assets to show off and stuff? And we're not trying ever to do a render shootout. But what we are saying is there's some really interesting subsurface research at this level, which requires more than 9 milliseconds. So let that team look at that problem, right? And I don't know if you've seen any of the stuff that's been going on in the subsurface community, but like it's really pushing hard on some new stuff that have come out of nuclear physics.
Yeah.
But there are other people that are interested in real time. And so they are not so much interested in that, you know, super high fidelity of the problems that you might have in a dipole, but they're looking at how can I get this looking good in really short amounts of time. So different companies are looking at different things, and everyone's playing nice, which I think is a huge step, right? For the artist community, you need to know that it isn't going to be locked into one pipe. Now, I love V-Ray, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that we wouldn't want to use V-Ray, but there are obviously, you know, applications where somebody might need to use something else, and we shouldn't, as an industry, not acknowledge that people have different needs for different things, and they have pipelines that have different requirements. And so it's to be everyone's credit, and particularly to Chris, because obviously he's from Chaos, that they're being so generous in allowing this to work the way that it is. I mean, it really is very, really healthy for the industry. I'd like to see more of this. And we have seen quite a lot in the open source community. Just to finish on the what else we're doing, we have actually got some really cool plans that I haven't even told Chris about yet.
Well, there's a couple of things I also want to mention. I know you have a question, so just please hold your question. We also, like, for example, the shader, we basically dismantled a V-Ray skin shader so that everyone could see how it was put together, so that you could basically put it, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 no matter what rendering engine you're using. So we know that what you can do, there's not necessarily a secret if you just sort of expose how the shader works. But then at the same time, everyone was talking about the new AL Surface shader, which is also an open source shader, designed originally for Arnold. But since it's open source, Vlado just imported it into V-Ray, and we made a V-Ray version of it. And guess what? Mike looks great with an AL Surface shader, so we're going to probably just use that since it's an open source shader anyway. So that's sort of the idea there.
I'd also like to add, outside of even the big hitters of the big companies in the VFX industry, this is a great educational tool. In and out of many colleges that I've gone and visited and talked to a lot of students, it's a great asset to point them to when they want to try to dive into to getting how to understand how to do hyper-real humans, but they're not much of a sculptor. Maybe they want to go into rendering. Maybe they want to go into animation. Maybe they want to play with just rigging. The Emily 2.0 data actually circulated a lot of the schools that I know of, the Art Institute, the Brooks Institute. Otis actually got a hold of it in some cases, and a lot of the students were able to play with it and get familiar with the type of data sets that might be able to be handed to them if they were to graduate and move into larger companies, so they didn't completely go in blind. It also gave them a test bed to be able to test other types of shaders, understand why they work. Why does this map do this? How deep does this number mean of subsurface scattering? Does it compare to this photo that's been supplied with me? In the MLE 2.0 data, we not only supplied the mesh, the maps, and any of all the assets, we also supplied them with a scene. The lighting directions were already plugged in compared to the reference photography, so that way they can do their renders and compare A to B, see how close they were. They weren't just having to shoot blind and hope for the best or look up tutorials that were completely unrelated to what they were playing with. So this is a great teaching asset. And so with Mike's more in-depth data set, I'm hoping it'll actually circulate again through the Educational Society, so that way it'd actually be more use.
Yeah, and having the animation is the next step too, you know. And of course, Peach Fuzz.
And Peach Fuzz. Chloe is doing a wonderful thing on Peach Fuzz.
Chloe's done some amazing research on Peach Fuzz. I saw her talk, and it was just really, really fascinating. So I'm very, very interested in exploring that as well. Mm-hmm. So yes, your question.
Thank you very much. I had a question for your correspondence. You mentioned that you were doing correspondence for your vertices for your blend shape, but regarding pixel and blood flow, what kind of technology you used? Was it like optical flow that you were using on your textures, or
so the tech?
So the question is, what kind of technology you used for your pixel correspondence, mm-hmm. and what other data you could get out of this correspondence of your textures?
So when you correspond your textures, you not only have the complete control of being able to, you know, blend the texture itself, which tends to bring along with the blood flow, but it also allows you to correspond normal maps or displacement maps, meaning you can have a lower resolution model, raise their eyebrows, smile, but then actually plug in the normal map or the displacement map, which would give you the creases that you would normally have to have a denser model for. If you don't have the capabilities or maybe just the bandwidth to render that, or if you're trying to do it in Unreal or trying to do it in real time, you're kind of limited in what you're capable of doing, so you want to pull it from the maps. If the maps are correspondent, then you're capable of doing that. The tools that we used in ICT, they were internal, but they do include optical flow. The logic of them is fun. We did a poster on this, the software, so you can actually find it. It used to be called Vuvuzela. The logic underneath it is that if you had two pieces of texture in 2D space, well, I'm fond of Photoshop, so we'll say Photoshop. You have them on two layers. And then you can actually take, say, the liquify tool and roughly pull the texture where it needs to be. Then you can run through an optical flow, and then it will do its best to find, you know, like-to-like correspondences between the two, and then try to align it pixel-wise. Some optical flows only use one color channel. Some use all of them. It all depends on which one you want to use. I'm not going to claim to know much about that because I went to art school and I'm not completely sure, but I know how to use the tool. But that is fundamentally the concept. Vuvuzela is not commercially released. You can look up the poster, though, and read about it, and you might be able to replicate it. I replicated it personally at home because my computer could not handle Vuvuzela, so I kind of jerry-rigged it a bit. But yeah, it's finally you want to do a broad motion, and then you want to do the fine-tuned motion with something like optical flow.
Another thing that was interesting was Koki, who is also a member of the team, and he took the digital Emily asset and it was doing his own research on skin deformation or wrinkle deformations that happen from different expressions. So
it wasn't even wrinkles, it was the microgeometry.
The microgeometry. So as I was mentioning before, we had the microgeometry that shows all the subpore levels. Now what happens, if you look at my cheek when I have it, when I do this, it's going to sunk in, but when I blow it out, the cheek puffs up and all that skin stretches out. And when that happens, the shine on my face gets brighter, right? So that's because all that skin gets stretched up. So what he was doing is he was creating blurs and sharpens of the microgeometry in different areas as different expressions would happen. So you would see the cheek become shinier and not shinier. Basically, it's the same BRDF completely, but all the microgeometry is changing its appearance that gives the illusion of either becoming more dense or stretched out.
It's similar to replacing using a specular roughness map. A specular roughness map, you could paint the region of the face, which part your nose is shinier than your cheek. If you're like me, your chin gets oily when you don't want it to, but your forehead's fine. But a lot of that has to do also not only with the what's on your skin, oil and such, but it has to do with the roughness on your cheek, or the roughness of your skin. And what Koki was doing, and this is actually quite a fascinating paper, it was fun to work on at SeaGraph, is that he would calculate tension maps during the animations. So he would calculate how much tension would be pulled across the skin here, while the smile would be here and they would bunch here. And then he would sharpen and blur in those regions accordingly. So when he would sharpen, it would actually give us a sharper lobe. When he would blur, it would give us a duller lobe. And you can kind of see the effect, at least on my hand, but that just might be because my hand's not right. But you can shine a light on it, and if you stretch it, you can kind of see the small little facets in your skin kind of elongate. And then you crunch it, and you see them kind of compress. Your face does that, like crazy, like absolutely crazy. And it's really not comfortable when you haven't slept in 4 days and they want to stick a camera right here on your face in the middle of the night for measurements. But it's a fascinating paper, and it actually feeds a lot to the vitality of the skin. The original microgeometry paper prior to the stretching and the compressing one, we also discovered that the skin looks pretty good when you actually give it two specular lobes. One for the broader, that actually scatters across the skin more, and then a sharper one that actually gives you the glints off of the smaller shine. So these are just little things that you start to find out when you start really, getting really close to people.
One thing I really want to note about the data that we were getting from ICT is it's pretty much scientifically acquired. It's very well calibrated. They know exactly what it is. It's measured. We know what it is. It's extremely accurate. And because of that, and because of the enormous density and of the data, we're only dealing with geometry, a diffuse map, a specular map, and a displacement map. That's it. And I fed that into a single AL surface shader. And that's all it was. Because the data was accurately, correctly done, I didn't have to worry about messing anything else up. So it's really a testament to it. And that's actually my goal. My goal is not to basically tell you, look how amazingly complicated my skin shader is, and it's so awesome. When you do that, you're actually just destroying the fact that you have this data. It should come out, if you put two into the machine, it should come out two on the other side if we did the right thing. So that's the idea I have. But yes, we have a question.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. It's really interesting. It's great work. I'm wondering if you guys have started looking into muscle or fascia simulation aspects as you get into the animation side, or looking at other deformers, or
I have heard about that, and I've been fascinated. Basically, some of the stuff that Mark Sager was doing on with muscles was fascinating, but I know that I was just talking to Doug Global yesterday, and he told me he saw some incredible work being done on muscles from ILM. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it in a few places, and it's some of the challenges that I've come across with facial rigging is getting very linear transitions between your key poses.
Right, and between the blend shapes.
So building in those substructures or having deformers or mechanisms to account for that seems mm-hmm. like it becomes a critical aspect to believable motion, even if you have wonderfully high resolution scans like you have.
I would love to do it. And honestly, this is a thing, right? So people are welcome to contribute to the WikiHuman project if they're willing to give back the results in some way. They don't have to give their proprietary tools. I'm not asking for that. But if they contribute back in some way that we can get some results, it would be great. The muscle system is something that I'm fascinated by. The other thing I'm actually fascinated by is the deep learning aspect, right? The deep learning is really going to change everything we do in this industry, from facial animation, that it just can fill in all the gaps that are missing, right, in a lot of ways. And that's also what they're like, even what they're doing in fluid sims now. They're doing fluid sims with deep learning because, like, don't worry, I kind of know where you're going, and the computer just does the rest in deep learning as AI, which is kind of amazing. And they're doing it now for rendering as well. So I really, really think that a lot of these different technologies are going to be apropos. Actually, one of the things we've even talked about is, why don't we try it in all of them and see how they do? Let's break it. I want to break Mike a lot so that I know what's working and what's not working, right? I want to know, like, for example, does this work better? Does that work better? One of the things I've always been wanting to do is looking at blood flow, right? There's been a really fascinating, there's a I'll tell this story real quickly, but because I know we're kind of running out of time. But the friend of mine was looking at a video of something that was done by MIT, which basically what they did is they took regular video and they took the color of the skin and they saw how the skin's color was changing from frame to frame and enhanced that change by 100 times. And in doing so, you could see the blood flowing in and out of the face, right? Just going in and out of the face. And so his point was, because he actually was in the Iraq War and he saw someone that was dead, nothing wrong with their face at all, but he knew immediately that person was dead. He says, I know that person was dead. You can just see it. And his idea is, I have a feeling that we see people's blood flow, we just don't see the difference. And so I want to test Mike and say, what if we did Mike with blood flow moving through his face and without blood flow, no change of expression whatsoever, would we notice a difference?
Actually, we've done some of that work already.
Right.
We did it at ICT. We did video sequencing, and there's actually three types of blood flow. There's expression-based blood flow, which is like a hemoglobin redistribution, and there's pressure flow, which is like you take your hand off and then the pressure is relieved and blood comes back in. And then the third one is the emotional blood flow, where it can be relatively neutral but getting very embarrassed and I go red. And so we've got those timed out, and then we used a similar method to the MIT method to enhance the we've got now some really good data on the rates of those blood flows and how they're really quite different, like some up to 6 seconds, some are almost instantaneous, and some aren't what the industry think they are. Right. So we're looking forward to publishing that.
Well, we've only got about a few more minutes, so if there's one more question, we'll take it.
Yeah, I was just going to follow on to that sort of same point about the blood flow and the muscle stuff. I'm wondering, do you know if anyone's done any high-speed photography to kind of measure? I mean, sounds like you have for the blood flow a bit, but I also wonder, like, do you get muscle bounce in your facial muscles? Obviously, they're small muscles, so I would expect it to be really, really fast.
So here's a related point that you might find fascinating. So you saw that I was lying on the floor there for my eye scan. We actually think that my eyeball flattened a bit because I was lying on my back because of the weight in it. We didn't realize that when we were putting my eyes in, and we were trying to work out why the specular highlights on the front of my eyes weren't quite working the way we thought they would. And we think that they actually flattened out because I was lying on my back when we got it scanned, which brings into question a lot of stuff that happens with MRIs, right? fMRIs and stuff, and like when you're getting people scanned, like what pose they're actually in for the weight distribution. We certainly think that that happens. And just to pick up on the Mark Sager point, Mark's point, which I think is really interesting, is everybody tends to assume that, you know, you look at that book that shows the muscles of the face, like a anatomy book, that that's the deal. Mark, because he's a really good friend of mine and kind of weird, has gone to autopsies where they've been taking people's faces off. And so, I know, he is a really nice guy. But the thing is, the ribbons are actually quite different between people. So it would be really handy if we had a good way of being able to determine what, say, Jay's or my ribbon shape, the muscle ribbon shapes are, because they're not attached to the bone at the front here, they're coming from the back, and the actual width of those and they're actually quite different between people. And so we have these underlying assumptions about that. And as we get further into our subsurface scarring models, and we need to have the internal stuff modeled correctly, both for the sims of the flesh and for the simming of the blood flow and the subsurface scattering, it actually matters what those underlying structures are. So yes, their weight distribution, the individual characteristics of them. But I mean, this is the level we're getting at, which is, if you think about it, off the dial, like ridiculously high. But you guys are all just so attuned to faces. You are just face experts. That, like, you don't have to do this for a laptop. You do something vaguely like a laptop. It's a really good laptop, right? But in CG, if you do a face that's like really good, like I had people coming up to me down there going, oh, you know, I think your face is like in the thing, in the little corner of the thing. And I'm like, really? We've got 9 milliseconds. I can't even like think that fast. Anyway, so it's like you're just so good at faces. So unfortunately, as an industry, we're faced with this problem that to pull off the you know, the holy grail, the Manhattan Project of our generation in graphics, we just have to go to ridiculous levels, at least it seems to us, ridiculous levels, to nail this stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've run out of time. We could keep going, and I would love to keep going, but we're going to be talking more about Meet Mike tomorrow at a panel, is that correct? So those of you who want to attend that, that's in room 411 at 3:45.
Yeah, and that panel will have considerably more on the real-time engine, because we didn't cover that today, because Chris Evans is coming to that, and Chris is, of course, from Epic Games, and so I'll be able to handle that part of the discussion.
Great.
He's a sweetheart.
Well, I want to thank our awesome guests and my good friends, Jay and Mike, for being here. And